This is the fourth in a series on silence, solitude, self-renewal, and might be one of the best because it's the first time we've had a crowd this small. Although surprisingly, in the other groups, even with a large number of people, there's been a real willingness to share, and I've appreciated that. We've been starting these sessions quietly, looking each time at some slides which have little aphorisms on them by Bernard Gunther and illustrated by Mary Carita. Some of you may know her as Sister Mary Carita. Some of you may know her as Mary Carita, others as Carita Kent, all the same person. So we're going to just look at these quietly for a couple of minutes. Your Full Love It, which is also the title of the session for today. The first session that we had earlier this week, we discussed the pain and the glory of being alone. The pain being experienced as loneliness and the glory as solitude. We also talked about two sides of silence, both human silence and divine silence. One side which is a distancing, absent side, a side that shuts out, that enervates and seems to take away our energy, like the stubborn silence of a child that doesn't want to cooperate with us, or of a spouse, or our own stubborn silence that we sometimes turn towards someone else or towards a new idea, perhaps. Well, there's another kind of silence, however, which is just the opposite. It's accepting, it's near, it encloses you as a sort of a silence that is full of potential for creativity, the sort of silence that in the very first chapter of Genesis is broken into by the word that says, "Let there be light." Yesterday we had a very lively discussion, I thought, about varieties of prayer. And we talked about solitude and silence as being preparation for entering into a deeper life of prayer. Today I want to come at some of those same questions again from just a slightly different angle by changing the metaphor. And instead of talking about either loneliness or solitude, or talking about silence and noise, I want to talk a little bit about emptiness and fullness. The Carita slide here says, "You're full, love it," or "you're full of it." And I would just like you, if possible, to share with us together right now some of the feelings that you get or some experiences you maybe equate with emptiness or fullness. Does it come to your mind immediately an experience that's empty for you? Moving away, someone who's close. Well, we even talk about the empty nest syndrome.
Yeah, I guess that's where I got that.
I suppose several of us have had that feeling. My wife and I will be at that this fall now, because our second daughter is leaving. Our second child is leaving for college. Although we have ambivalent feelings about it, I think there are some.
That's true.
We're expecting some kinds of fullness to result as well.
The refrigerator stays full. The house stays clean. The refrigerator's not as empty.
Yeah. Anybody else have something you could share?
Well, I get sometimes both almost at the same time. At the end of a hard day's work, I feel kind of empty from energy, but I also feel full because I felt that it's been a good day, I feel something's been accomplished, I feel good about it.
Mm-hmm.
So while there's an emptiness of energy and emotion, there's a fullness that it was complete. It's a very quiet fullness for myself.
Are there days when you don't feel that way?
Oh yeah. There are days where I feel empty and it's not full.
Mm-hmm.
quieting fullness or that feeling of that where it's just empty.
So it's not just the fact that you've done a lot of activity. There's got to be some quality about the activity or what resulted from the activities.
Usually.
I spend a sabbatical year here from August to August, and I thought it would be a time of filling up. But it seemed to be a time of getting rid. And that when summer came, suddenly I had nothing to say or nothing. It was over. Maybe it's because it was over, but I just really felt empty. I don't think it was exhaustion. I don't think it was depression. I think I just must have been chucking off the old and getting ready to start something new.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that way at the end of a school year, and I come out here to go hiking, and I feel just empty. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's depression or fatigue or anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of energy in teaching, so you need to just relax.
I think that's true. Anybody who's ever taught can share in that feeling. I think the end of the semester syndrome, though, is something that hits a lot of students as well. I've noticed on my campus that you often hit certain points where a lot of people start getting sick. And it will often come towards the end of a semester, or in Oshkosh it'll come after a long winter if spring just doesn't want to come. And you're well into April and it's still terrifically cold, and people start falling like flies. And it's just everything starts happening to them. And it's as if there's no more inner resource to keep you healthy and full and alive. And it's as if you just sort of saying, okay, you've been emptied out or drained out of life-giving energies, and anything can now start attacking you and tear you down. I don't know if it's anxiety also that starts coming up before final exams as well. That's very common on college campuses, I would think, from my limited experience and from what I've heard others say.
Interesting, when I saw your full love, it suddenly struck me something that Norm Nagel said a few years back when he was here. He was talking about people in far-off countries, let's say Africa, who are hungry, they're empty. Guilt one feels as one is being full and fed well here, knowing how in the world you get that food over there, because by the time you can get it there, it'd be spoiled and you can't do anything.
Yeah.
One of the things that he remarked after his session was, appreciate the strawberries.
Hmm.
That you take what God gives you and be thankful that you can really relish enjoy the strawberry, knowing that it's a gift, but that there's no way you can transport that strawberry to Africa that they can enjoy, and you just have to accept that gift and really be thankful.
Mm-hmm.
You're full. Love it. Start with me.
Yeah, that's a striking observation. Because there are several articles that I gathered together here, which have been passing around the village. There, maybe you've seen them, people reading them or passing them around, because they have these little green sheets on the covers. But two of those articles deal precisely with Mary Karita and her art. And one of them is by a theologian, which appeared in the Christian Century. Oh, this is already almost 20 years ago, February 1969. Ron Sunby wrote this. And he entitled that article, The Naivete of Karita. And in this article says that she's got bad theology. And it's just much too simple. For example, he quotes one of these aphorisms, which has, to believe in God is to know that all the rules will be fair and that there will be wonderful surprises. And he responds, one wonders if Miss Kent has ever read the book of Job. What does it mean to say all the rules will be fair? Must the Negro believe in that kind of God to have a faith? Must individuals who are crippled in mind, body, or spirit believe that all the rules are fair? And then she's got another one that she wants illustrated. To believe in God is to know purple jelly beans could hatch to yellow ostriches, and tulip bulbs break into blooms big as moons, or even rabbits could produce humans out of hats, and it would be all the same, --, Easter. Well, he doesn't like this one either. He says, to pastors who have struggled to convey the concept of a law-abiding universe to their confirmation, to their congregations, that affirmation comes as bad news. It sets the theological world of reason back by centuries. It sounds pretty, but is what it says pretty? Do we really want a topsy-turvy, unreliable kind of existence where purple jelly beans can hatch yellow ostriches? Not I. I want purple jelly beans that I can eat without fear of yellow ostriches hatching forth in my stomach. And then he goes on again. This was one I think that I put on the board the other day. To believe in God is to know that all our stars are lucky ones. And Sunby replies, tell that to the young student who failed a big exam, or to the person who just learned she's got cancer, or to the hardworking fellow who didn't get his promotion. All our stars lucky? Ridiculous. Who then would believe in God if it's all just this way? And so he criticizes her for being too simple. And when you brought up this thing, Larry, about those who don't have food, one wonders if we would break down the wall right here between the fireside room and the dining room, and those that are talking now about South Africa just one wall away from us, you know, what would they say about anyone who might want to bring this, say, to people, black people in South Africa who are struggling for their freedom? Can you in good conscience bring this as a message to them, saying, you're full, love it? Could that be done? Or could it not?
Not in words. It would be interesting. I have never experienced South Africa, so I really don't know. The first one that you quoted, to believe in God, that's one that I own. Mm-hmm. And I've never thought of it up that way. And I have been a follower of her, and I think one needs to, like scripture, one needs to look at the total picture instead of just picking out little aspects of it.
It just reminds me, when you ask that question, that man's hierarchy of needs, and before you can go up to really giving thought to something like this, you've got to have your basic needs fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And food is their very basic need, and then shelter and a lot of other things before they could look there and say, mm-hmm. Oh, love it.
Can't send them our mimeographic concern.
Yeah. There's another article. I want to show you the other side on Carita with at least one other article. This is one that appeared in Newsweek just a couple of years ago, 1984. And I think many of us know that Mary Carita struggled in the last several years of her life with her health, and she just died within this past year. And of course, she also had struggled years ago, I think, with her sense of vocation. She had originally been a Roman Catholic sister, been in the convent, and then with her art and her reading and other things began to reach out and eventually left the convent. I can't imagine that she did that without a struggle. But here's a quotation from Carita. She said she tries to put a kind of honesty in her work, and a kind of harmony. One of my greatest teachers, she says, told me that a painting was a symbol for the universe. Inside it, each piece relates to the other. Each piece is only answerable to the rest of that little world. And so, probably in the total universe, there is that kind of total harmony. But we get only little tastes of it. That's why people listen to music or look at paintings, to get in touch with that wholeness. I'm putting a lot of little symbols out in the world that are giving people little tastes of what harmony is like. And then the writer of this article, Mary Bruno, goes on to say, "For every splash of color in Corita's world, there is also a sobering phrase. Her nearly 700 silk screens have quoted Nietzsche, 'You must carry a chaos inside you to give birth to a dancing star.' E.E. Cummings, 'Be of love a little more careful than of anything.' And Corita Kent's own words, 'We live in one world and each act affects the whole.' Among her favorite statements is this Zen word, 'After ecstasy, the laundry.'"
She also says, "Damn everything but the circus."
Yes.
"Damn everything but what?
Circus.
Circus."
That's another E.E. Cummings, isn't it? "Damn everything but the circus."
A lot of splashy colors. Brights.
I think her work really evokes sort of paradoxical feelings in us, and I think that sense of both emptiness and fullness, this might be something, you know, as we've discussed, that seems too simple to give to certain people, to say you're full, love it. On the other hand, I'm always struck by the fact that in the New Testament, at least, Jesus is pictured as having the most sympathetic hearing among the poor, and it's precisely to those sort of people that he, you know, that he presents the Beatitudes. And in effect saying, empty though you appear, you really are those who are full. And full though others may appear, they may very well be among those who are empty. And so for me, Corita's art is very evocative, especially because I don't believe that she was just a person who lived on the surfaces and wanted to paint cute little sayings. I really feel that, especially because of her own background and her own spiritual struggles and her own struggles with physical health, that there must have been more to it than just, you know, nice little marshmallow words to kind of hang around in the house on the refrigerator so you don't get too depressed from time to time.
Have you worked with earlier pieces when she was excited about television commercials and just carried them so far that it gave them a twist?
Yes, like the Wonder Bread commercial and Sun-Kissed Lemons, some of those things. Which was, it seems to me, also a way of trying to make spiritual statements with things that are right in the world every day. No, I don't have those with me. One was something that she had, Wonder Bread, Bill's Bodies, Eight Strong Ways, and it had these little red dots, you know, from the Wonder Bread wrapper, kind of kicking around, and part of it was upside down, and there were some colors that interrupted. But I think she was relating a lot of that to the idea of the resurrection. And the same thing with the purple jelly beans and the yellow ostriches. I mean, she relates that to Easter. And it would appear to me that someone who complains about Easter bringing surprises has missed the whole point of Easter.
She did a lot with Ponce tomatoes or catsup. It becomes, I mean, it is what it is, but it also becomes blood, shit. I can't remember how she rearranged the words. It's straight out of the advertising.
She also used the Wonder Bread theme, I think, carried on in some other prints too, about the bread given
for oh, sure.
in the blood shed. She carries that Eucharistic theme on her Wonder Bread. Just like the sun-kissed oranges or sun-kissed lemons, where she then starts moving into Son Kiss, S-O-N-K-I-S-S, as in the Son of God, Kiss.
So that the aphorisms, in a way, work very much like little Zen sayings. They're supposed to kind of surprise you into an awareness. I was curious, Larry. What, you know? Well, we were talking about emptiness and fullness. Have you ever gotten that kind of a sense when you've been out on some of your geological hikes? I'm just looking at some of your slides. I had a sense the other day of just almost desolation when I thought of this, the immense power in some of these volcanic eruptions, and if there's so much there to accomplish a big blow off or something, you know.
I'm essentially a loner anyway, and it's very hard for me to interact with people. When I get out in nature, climb from the desert, wherever, I have a different book to read. I'm constantly alive, alert, to see who I can see. So although it looks as if I'm alone, I'm just fascinated with what I see and learn. So I'm not really alone at all. I'm just excited.
Dialoguing with nature.
For anyone somebody else who can't see all these things,
It's
dreadfully alone.
An empty sky, I assume, is never empty for you.
No, not really.
No such thing.
I'm marveling that God can make that blue. It was really black. The light's being scattered.
Standing by the sea on a bright day, you just see that one line out there.
Yeah.
But it's very... What is it? It's palpable, all that emptiness. It's very solid, real, huge.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to speak of emptiness, being palpable. Almost something you can touch. Sometimes we have hurts, I think, that are like that. Like a deep emptiness inside, and you almost think that you could hold it.
I'm feeling I'm talking too much. I know these people are thinking deeply while they're there, so I'm not talking about that.
I found what you had to say very, very stimulating. That you can look at all of that desolation with all your knowledge behind, can really appreciate it all and question it. And
wouldn't you be able to appreciate it even if you didn't have any knowledge?
Not to the same extent. I think the knowledge that he shared that I've seen since I've been here is going to help me appreciate it a whole lot more than I did since my sixth grade geography class.
Unfortunately, you're going to be a real hazard on the road now.
Every time you go driving. Yeah. But what? There's somebody up here looking over too. What are the experiences that give you a sense of great fullness, if we don't want to talk that much about emptiness? When would you feel like what it says up here, you're full of it?
Thanksgiving Day.
Thanksgiving Day, huh?
Too much.
Much better than the way that I feel it. All the beauty around it's pretty blessed with eyesight.
A good hike.
It occurs to me that fullness is really uncomfortable. I mean, Thanksgiving and a hike, too many good things and too many wonderful people, too much stimulation, too many ideas.
Almost to a point of hurt, right?
You just gotta get away from it.
it's like we're trying to go out and become full, and what that's saying is, you're already full. Mm-hmm. You're full. Love it. Instead of going out and overeating or overstimulation on a hike or trying to find that fullness, it's like the statement saying to me, you are full. Love it.
There's at least, you know, some biblical precedent for a statement like this. If you look in those first chapters, for example, of John's Gospel, I wrote that down in my notes, where you have the picture of the divine emptying itself to become enfleshed among us, but the other half of it says, of his fullness all of us have received grace upon grace, or you could translate it love upon love. And it would appear to me that that would be something that we should be able to experience and be more than just a statement written down in a scripture that you believe. What's the sense of having statements that are objects for belief? I don't know that it does you much good, except to help you win arguments once in a while, which generally leave you feeling empty anyway afterwards. Because you haven't accomplished anything except embarrassing an opponent, or the opponent has embarrassed you, and there's not much that comes out of it. But if indeed that's a palpable truth, and more than just a statement on the page, then it would appear to me we should be waiting for, or alive to, or sort of just, you know, expectant that that kind of fullness would make itself known in our lives and in our activities. And the surprise I've often found is that the fullness often is there just at the time when you appear most empty. And that's also got an interesting New Testament sort of a precedent, because Paul speaks that way about Jesus in Philippians. That taking on the form of a servant and being completely emptied, Jesus is then given the title of Lord, so that all knees, you know, in heaven, earth, and under the earth, bow at that name. And that paradoxical emptiness and fullness. I've certainly had that experience sometimes when I visited people who are terminally ill. And once in a while you try to think of what you're going to say, you know, to the person, and you maybe have it all worked out, a scenario in your mind even. We were talking about fantasy yesterday. And then when you get there, you discover you really have nothing to say. And you can feel incredibly empty. And it may be that the person who appears to have no energy and be dying or whatever and be drained of strength has really something to give to you. And you are awakened again to the incredible fullness that really is there, that overflowing kind of fullness. There's also biblical precedent in the story of the, you know, the well of living water in John 4. Emptiness and fullness are very close to appetite kind of metaphors. And those who are always thirsting to get more and more and more and more, whereas those who often seem to have little and have fewer appetites and fewer thirsts seem to just overflow and be able to give more and more and more. It's very paradoxical. And there's not much more you can do, it seems to me, very often than to just sort of be receptive for that experience. I'm not sure how you cultivate that, if it's something that can be cultivated. I'm seeking for a little help on that purposely. That's why Holden is so neat. You really do get a lot of people who will share those things. When you were talking about, you know, older age, I was struck by the thought of my own parents who have lived very full lives and are still, they're still able to give so much. They're both in their mid-70s. And they, I think if you looked at their home and their possessions, they're fairly modest. I mean, they're not hurting for anything. But they seem to have so much to give to people, just the very sight of the two of them getting along the way they do. I mean, they argue fairly often. We all know now what the arguments are. It's almost like a liturgical, it's like liturgically set. We know, you know, when we're moving from the Kyrie to the Gloria. It's sort of, you know, you can predict, all the grandchildren even can predict it. You know, they'll bump each other with elbows when this starts. It's wonderful. They all know it's going to happen, but they also know that it's going to be short-lived, it's going to be over with, and that they've so, you know, and they have so much to share, and they give so much to the family. We don't expect anything else from them. To the very fact of their example, and that they've gotten through it so well and stayed together, and you wouldn't need anything else from them for Christmas, for Easter, for anything. And they should. I would never want them to feel that somehow there's not something that they can keep giving. They really don't have to do anything. All they have to do is be who they are. We don't ask anything more of them. It's sufficient. So that Buddhist saying I quoted the other day, don't just do something, stand there.
My father is 80 and in a retirement community, and he sees lots of women who've lost their husbands, and some of whom are being put there by children who never visit them. So he always goes around as a word of encouragement and fills these people with what their needs. We'll talk to them concerning.
I brought along Hermann Hesse's novel, Siddhartha. I don't know if any of you have ever read this. Is anybody acquainted with this novel? I noticed there are several copies in the Holden bookstore. It's one of my favorite novels, and I began using it, 8-10 years ago at least, as one of the readings in my course on Introduction to Religion. I have all my students read it and usually write a short report, and sometimes we spend 4 or 5 days in class picking up on various ideas that are in this book. But there's one wonderful description. It's about a young man whose name is Siddhartha, and he goes through a whole series of experiences in his life of every kind you can think of, just about. And of course, it's a way of the author is showing of a young man maturing and finally having the whole circle of a life complete. But there's one very powerful symbol that comes fairly early in the novel. Young Siddhartha and his buddy's name is Govinda, who also is a hanger-on. He hangs on Siddhartha. He will never make any choices of his own. Anything Siddhartha does, he does. You know, he's like the younger brother, sort of. He always wants to do what big brother does, although they're the same age. He's hanging on him. And the two of them go off to kind of seek their fortune a little bit, and they come across the Buddha. It's set in India at the time that the Buddha was preaching. And when they meet the Buddha really doesn't have to say anything. And the two of them immediately recognize him out of a huge crowd, a whole bunch of saffron-robed monks who are begging and so forth. But they immediately know who he is. Siddhartha saw him and recognized him immediately, as if pointed out to him by a god. He saw him, bearing an alms bowl, quietly leaving the place, an unassuming man in a yellow cowl. "Look," said Siddhartha softly to Govinda, "there is the Buddha." Govinda looked attentively at the monk in the yellow cowl, who could not be distinguished in any way from the hundreds of other monks, and yet Govinda too recognized him. It was he. And they followed him and watched him. The Buddha went quietly on his way, lost in thought. His peaceful countenance was neither happy nor sad. He seemed to be smiling gently inwardly. With a secret smile not unlike that of a healthy child, he walked along peacefully, quietly. He wore his gown and walked along exactly like the other monks. But his face and his step, his peaceful downward glance, his peaceful downward hanging hand, and every finger of that hand spoke of peace, spoke of completeness, sought nothing, imitated nothing, reflected a continuous quiet, an unfading light, an invulnerable peace. Well, as it happens, Govinda decides to stay in the company and become a disciple of the Buddha, and he's accepted in to the company. Siddhartha is unable to do that, because even though Siddhartha hears the Buddha's teachings, he says to the Buddha, "I think those are wonderful teachings and they're the best I've ever heard, but I don't know whether I'm able to follow teachings. I expect that you found your own way and I would like to go my own way." And it's a sign of the Buddha's emptiness and lack of possessiveness that all he does is to look at Siddhartha with a great, compassionate, loving smile and says in effect to him, "You're very thoughtful. Beware of too much cleverness." And lets him go. After which Siddhartha then goes into a period where he feels a tremendous emptiness, because he says, "The Buddha has robbed me. He has robbed me of my best friend, Govinda." On the other hand, he feels a great fullness, because he says, "And he has given me myself." And he starts feeling like a little child, as if he's fresh to go out into the whole world. That always reminds me, of course, of the biblical story of Jesus and the children saying, "Unless you receive the kingdom like a little child, there's no way you're ever going to enter into it." But in Buddhism, emptiness is what's sought. Shunya. And that idea of being non-attached. But you could hardly say of this Buddha, empty though he was, that he wasn't full. And it appears that, you know, that same secret about fullness and emptiness is in this novel about Siddhartha and is the experience of the Buddha, very similar to what Christians experience too. That at the point where you've denied yourself, we used to talk about that, where you've denied yourself, that's where the possibility for fullness really is present.
I wonder if there's a contrast between inward fullness and upward fullness. I don't know what I'm saying is right. I'm feeling that Buddhism may be an inward-directed kind of philosophy, whereas Christianity is an outward concern for others.
Well, I think we often see Buddhism that way sometimes. We see it as being too, maybe, self-centered. But you really couldn't say it's self-centered, because part of the idea is to lose the self. And Buddhism, despite the fact of how individual it is in some aspects, you know, the three jewels are: you take refuge in the Buddha, you take refuge in the teaching, and you take refuge in the community. And so, again, the fact that you can let go and the fact that you can seek your own solitude and silence is seen as a gift you give to each other. Just as, in a sense here, the Buddha never left Siddhartha. If you read the rest of this novel, I hope someday you will, because I think it's a wonderful novel. He never sees the Buddha again. But if one could use Christian lingo, one could say that the Buddha remains with him always, even to the end of the novel. Because at the end of the novel, Siddhartha himself has become an enlightened one. He has become so filled with the Buddha nature himself that the next time when Govinda meets him at the end, he sees that same kind of peace radiating from Siddhartha, that same kind of fullness. And it isn't as though Siddhartha had dropped out of life. He hadn't. He'd been involved in all sorts of things. In fact, he had even become terribly greedy at one time. He'd become infected with gambling. He'd become an apprentice to a merchant and had learned all the kinds of ways of swindling other people and of even swindling other merchants. And goes through a suicidal stage at one time. And yet the novel, in a sense, or Hesse's message in the novel, is that even at those points where he appeared most empty, there was still something that was keeping him alive and going. There was a hidden wholeness, a hidden fullness. Some of you may look for that book in the library here, which has photographs by Thomas Merton and also by his friend John Howard Griffith. And it's entitled A Hidden Wholeness, which is a phrase of Thomas Merton's. No matter what it always looks like on the surface, there is a hidden wholeness underneath that holds everything together. I also want to think of, when you think of emptiness, I think the metaphor that comes up often is space. It's a space kind of a metaphor. There's something out there. I don't know if it comes to any of you as a time. Do you think of emptiness as being like empty times? I usually think of space.
When somebody dies, you suddenly feel eternity. It's hard to sit here and think about eternity, but when somebody dies, there's this silence that's sort of eternity. It's great. There won't be any more good morning or any, all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of emptiness.
Yeah, I had a striking revelation a few weeks ago when my mother-in-law died. About 6 years ago now. It came on a morning that was a very full morning for us. It was a May morning. It was commencement day at the university. My wife had just gone to a big ceremony to pin the nursing graduates. The nursing students who were graduating was held at the Newman Center just off campus. And while she was at this, joyful ceremony with all this stuff going on, she was in the College of Nursing at that time, I got the phone call from father-in-law that mom had died that night. And I felt, I just didn't know how I was going to present this to Barbara when she came back home. Because she was in this, it was an exciting, gorgeous, beautiful May morning. Everything was in full bloom. A sunny day, and she was coming back from this nice graduation ceremony, and I had to break that news to her, and that was one of the emptiest times I've ever felt in my life, and it was precisely at a time when everything seemed full. Just all seemed so full. And later in the day, after, crying and hugging and all the rest, children and her, we were able to drive down the 80 miles to Milwaukee. And we were able to see Mom in the one of the rooms at St. Joseph's Hospital. I had called ahead and asked whether we might just be able to say a farewell before she was, the body was taken to the undertaker and so forth. And they were quite willing to do that, and they were very accommodating and said they've done that for other families too. So we spent a couple of minutes with the body and said a few words, and that, I think for Barbara and me especially, that opportunity to say goodbye and to be close was very meaningful. But I found out just recently that, and for my son too, it was a very fulfilling experience. I found out just recently that for my daughter, that had been a terrible experience, because she felt that there was absolutely nothing that any of us could do to take away the loss and the pain, and that we were just trying to cover it up by doing that. And she wrote about all the empty words that we were saying. I saw she wrote an essay for her high school senior class recently. And she wrote about all those empty words that were coming out of this black book, because we also read a psalm together, one of our favorite psalms, and how those words meant absolutely nothing to her, and she felt this great sense of distance and alienation. And we were all there close together. And so for her, evidently, the time when she's going to be healed from that experience of one of her grandmother's death is still to come. And I think the other three of us in the family have felt at least a large amount of healing about that, because we felt so grateful that we were able to have this time and say goodbye. And I felt so good about those people at St. Joseph's Hospital who were so cooperative. I thought, what neat people. And they really wanted to give us an opportunity. You know, and it felt good for us. But Rebecca, no. And so she still has a kind of an emptiness there that's waiting to be filled in its own good time, whenever that happens. And I think that's another paradox about emptiness and fullness. You may think you're having a tremendously fulfilling experience with some other person or other group of persons, and you find out not everybody in the group shared it.
I had that experience with my grandfather that. For me, it was a full time. And during the funeral, I wasn't upset, I didn't cry. And it wasn't because I wasn't into the funeral, because I was a teenager at the time. It's just that we were close, and he had lived to, 89, and it was fine. It was okay. And then a few months later, a classmate of mine gets killed in an auto crash, actually about a year later, and I go to pieces at the funeral. Just, and it upset me for months, because he did not live the full life, where my grandfather did. So I felt full at my grandfather's funeral, while others didn't. I know my mother didn't for a while.
I saw a sign on somebody's desk that said, "We all lead lives of quiet desperation." When I go to church sometime and ask somebody, "How are you?" and they say, "Fine," I'm always moved to say, "Now tell me the truth." Sometimes the mask slips and I hear the emptiness that's hidden behind the smiling face.
That's a gift too, I think, to be able to hear the emptiness behind. Well, maybe more of us do hear that, but then we feel afraid to respond to it.
As a therapist, you get conditioned to read faces or look behind the words. Mm-hmm.
Do you see fullness in your grandchildren's faces? Can you ever pick out when they're feeling empty, even if they're kind of covering up? Have you developed that ability?
My grandchildren are going through a terrible time right now. My daughter and her husband are separated. Mm-hmm. About 2 months ago. So it's a big emptiness for all of them.
Yeah. Well, there's one reason why you're needed right now, you see. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard, too. It's difficult for me often when I'm feeling empty, I have a hard time reaching out, generally, to others. And so I kind of think I need to find ways of being full again. And I also find it difficult when I know someone is very empty, and if they're playing a mask that they're full, I find it much more comfortable to play along with the game than to really to try and go behind the mask, because partly, I guess I feel that there are so many reserves in each of us. I really am convinced of your full love it with Karita, and that there's so many reserves of fullness there that I'm not too willing to jump in right away, as if somehow I'm the one who has to help out. And sometimes I think, you know, for people who are going through difficult times, it's good just to see someone else who's full, just as Siddhartha. He had that one view of the Buddha being so full. And he really didn't need anything else from the Buddha after that. He had seen it, he knew it was possible, and he knew it was possible for him and for everyone else, and that's all he needed. And eventually, that fullness did come around. So we'll leave it with this last picture from Karita, which says, "You are a sun, S-U-N, beam." Which again, that strikes me too, you know, when you say, "Who's my neighbor?" That's an empty statement. When Jesus turns around and says, "Who acted like the neighbor?" That's the full statement.
We all need our masks. We need somebody to look behind us.
Oh, that's one of my favorites. It says, "My heart is a serene homemade ice cream machine sending you all the flavors of love." And that last one.
Open flower or open flower.
Right.
Open and flower.
Which again is paradoxical, because we think of something that's closed up being full, whereas it may very well be empty. It's hiding what isn't even there. We think of open as being emptied out, where again it's precisely the opposite. When it's open, it may be that it's emptying out without limits.
Be open and you'll flower.
Mm-hmm.
Very frustrating to open a flower by yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Well, I think these make great mantras, and they're obviously the sorts of things that, you know, in another time or another place, one could actually use these as powerful helps toward meditation. Just sticking with one or another of them for some amount of time.